We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both formerly with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. A full plate for us today, starting with hemp. Hemp in Washington.
Yes, the state Senate down in Olympia passed a bill this week to legalize the industrial production of hemp. Hemp, for those of you who don't know, probably very few of our listeners, is the parts of the cannabis plant that contain very little THC, so they won't get you high quite like the buds and the parts that are sold in marijuana dispensaries here.
And it's worth pointing out that the state Senate in this case is the body that's controlled by the Republicans.
Yes. So. And, you know, hemp has many other uses, including it can be used for fiber, for example, for making clothing. Hemp oil is used in a lot of different applications, including things like soap and cosmetics. It can be hemp oil can be used in food, and it can possibly also be used as a biofuel since it grows very, very easily and very quickly, too. So Senate bill, as Jav said, Senate Bill 5012, it passed unanimously in the Republican Senate. So its chances in the House are very, very good.
The question with that, though, is that I believe hemp production is still not legal at the federal level. So, again, how does that conflict play out?
Well, we have marijuana growers here in Washington State, and so far, so good. So I'm assuming the same would hold true for hemp growers as well.
Good news, nonetheless. All right, moving on. Study coming out of the Department of Ecology.
Yeah, the State Department of Ecology this week released the preliminary outline, a draft of a draft rule requiring emissions cuts in Washington's transportation sector. Now, it's a draft of a draft rule, which means that Ecology isn't even sure yet that it will actually propose this rule and go through the formal rulemaking process. Governor Inslee asked them to release this draft of a draft and collect comments from the public and from legislators and other folks before actually starting the rulemaking process. Now, this draft of a draft would require fuel producers in the state of Washington to reduce the carbon emissions of their products by 10% over 10 years, so about 1% a year. To do that, they have several options. They can develop fuels that produce less carbon actually burn more cleanly than the current fuels. They could mix gasoline with biofuels so that it burns more cleanly in a mix, or they could buy credits under a cap and trade system. There'll be a public hearing later this month here in Seattle around February 19th with the time and date to be announced. So I would urge people to go out and comment on that and push for that rulemaking process to get started. Otherwise, this could die very quickly. And I just want to point out that the transportation sector, there are various bills that are being proposed in the legislature, but they would do things like require utilities to invest in clean energy. But according to the governor's panel that just studied what kind of a system we should put in place to regulate carbon emissions in the state of Washington, the transportation sector is the biggest carbon-producing sector in our economy. So this is something that's very important and that people should be commenting on.
And didn't we have an initiative back about 2006 or so that actually already required investment in clean energy?
You mean for utilities?
Yeah.
I think that was a local one.
No, that was a statewide.
Was that a statewide
one? That was statewide.
One? Yeah.
But it has not been implemented. So it's already on the books.
Really?
But
I'd have to look
still,
into that.
Still has not been implemented nearly a decade later.
And, you know, I think a lot of our utilities are moving towards cleaner energy. For example, shutting down the one coal-fired power plant that the state draws energy from. So that's already kind of in the works. But as I said, the transportation sector is where we should be really concentrating. So when that meeting comes up on February 19th, folks should go and should comment.
All right. Moving on to national, big news coming out of the chair of the FCC.
Yeah, the FCC chair Tom Wheeler, who spent his prior career to the coming of the FCC as the nation's chief cable industry lobbyist, so not exactly a grassroots-friendly kind of guy, and who had been pretty hostile in his past proposal his previous proposal for how to deal with net neutrality issue, pretty much reversed himself this week with his announcement to reclassify broadband as a common carrier, that under the Communications Act. And the purpose of that in treating it as a public utility would essentially be to codify net neutrality as the law of the land under the FCC, which is something grassroots activists, some 4 million of whom commented in the rulemaking process and the public comment process, weighed in favor of that, really in opposition to the major telecommunications companies. And it was widely expected that the FCC proposal and Wheeler's proposal would be very favorable to the telecommunications industry. Instead, it's been just the opposite. It's very good news in terms of what will be considered by the FCC, but at this point is just a proposal that's going forward to the FCC. It has not been approved yet, and there's also the possibility that Congress could turn around and pass something that would preempt what the FCC is doing here.
Yeah, this is a proposal from the chairman of the FCC. It's going to go before the full commission of 5 commissioners. They typically vote 3-2, two Democratic appointees plus the chairman versus the two Republican or conservative appointees. But it's not a done deal. And telecommunications companies are weighing in heavily. And as Jav said, they're also lobbying Congress. So Congress could pass a bill that that negates a lot of this. So it's very, very important for people who commented on this proposed rule last year to keep an eye out and to continue sending comments to your legislators in Congress saying, you know, don't interfere with what the FCC is doing.
Yeah. And for people who don't remember the context of this, the original push by the FCC, which this would essentially negate, was to create the fast lane. So the major telecommunications
That's
companies.
That's what Wheeler proposed initially.
Yeah, yes, the major players would have much faster access to the internet, and those companies in turn could also shut out or give much slower access speeds to, say, competing companies, people whose political speech the government doesn't like, whomever. Very disturbing proposal that a lot of people opposed. And that's still something that telecommunication companies are pushing hard for and that Wheeler's proposal would disallow. So what they're looking for here basically is a continuation of the type of internet that we already have. And that's what Wheeler's proposal would codify. And that's what the telecommunications companies are seeking to change.
Yeah. And what I find kind of interesting about all this, too, is that there's already a little bit of discrimination going on in access to the internet. You have to pay. And currently people pay for the amount of speed that they get. So that's already kind of the way things work right now. But this proposal would allow the FCC to really begin regulating it more like a utility, to be examining the practices of companies that provide access to the internet and so forth, so that could actually make things a little bit better and or make it a little bit easier to expand internet access to poor areas and rural areas, places that only still only have dial-up.
Yeah, and one of the context pieces of this also globally is that the United States has some of the slowest internet access and some of
the
least pervasive access to the internet of any, certainly developing countries, but also developing countries. It's very, very strange that the United States has fallen so far behind, and that specifically is because it's been left to the open market rather than being regulated like utility in the public interest, and that's what the FCC is seeking to codify. The longer term, the prospect is, in fact, for the United States to start catching up if it's treating it more like utility.
So very, very good news there.
All right. Well, that's two pieces of good news this morning. It's highly unusual, and I'm glad I'm sitting down.
It already exceeds our quota, and we're not even quarter of the way through the show, so who knows what might come.
All right. Well, I think we'll swing back the other way now. ACLU releasing some documents this week about license plate reading.
Yeah, the ACLU had filed a Freedom of Information Act on the DEA's DEA's automated license plate readers, aka ALPRs or ALPRs, which can take photos of your license plate
And this is only one of the many federal and state agencies that have gotten into this. Yes.
Yeah. And what the ACLU found in some of the documents that were released and that what they published this week is that the DEA's ALPERS technology, its license plate reader, can also take photos of the driver and passengers in an automobile. And what they found is that it can take and store up to 10 photos per vehicle, including 4 occupant photos. What they found, too, is that those photos are stored for long periods of time. And they concluded that photos of drivers and passengers are not just taken accidentally, but are actually gathered and saved intentionally, so that the DEA has unprecedented ability to track the movements and travel patterns of all Americans. Given that one of the main ALPER manufacturers, Vigilant Solutions, now offers, quote, integrated facial recognition technology with their license plate reader. Now people are not just getting your photos taken and stored. It's much, much easier for the DEA to put together, you know, to start doing searches for people, putting together where they go and when.
And one of the main defenses of the license plate technology is, well, we're just reading the license plates and tracking the vehicles. We're not actually tracking the individuals, which begs the question of why the manufacturer is not only created but is actively marketing the facial recognition software as well, if it weren't an integral part of why this technology is being used, as I said, not just by the DEA, but by a number of state and federal agencies.
The Drug Enforcement Agency. And a lot of this technology is being funded with money coming through the anti-terrorism programs, and a lot of it is being marketed as, you know, we can help you track the next Tsarnaev guy who's gonna, you know, plant a bomb and blow up a sporting event or whatever, you know. But it really is not being used for that. It's being used to track people, and the ACLU filed this Freedom of Information Act as part of a broader suit to look into the DEA's asset forfeiture program, stopping people searching for drugs, finding minute amounts of marijuana maybe, and then seizing their vehicle and everything they have with them. So there's been an outcry over police departments abusing asset forfeiture and the DEA as well, and the ACLU managed to get a hold of this very, very interesting information.
Yeah, and people may remember a few weeks ago where outgoing Attorney General Eric Holder had announced some reforms to mitigate some of the worst excesses of asset forfeiture programs, but it still left a number of the most problematic practices in place. So this is still a serious and ongoing problem.
Yeah.
Well, and the government agencies often share data with each other.
Oh, they do.
So you think?
There's no reason to believe the DEA is just going to be the only one looking at that. Moving on, President Obama releasing his proposed federal budget this week.
Yes, $4 trillion budget. On the expense side, the biggest glaring thing that stood out for me was the lots and lots of money for the Pentagon, especially for the Pentagon's big weapons programs. Obama wants to ask Congress to lift sequestration so that he can fund the Pentagon up to $534 billion, plus an additional $51 billion for the wars in Iraq and Syria. So $51 billion to fight ISIS, essentially, or ISIL, however you want to call them. Also, some other things on the expense side that look pretty good are more money for infrastructure projects. That's roads, bridges, airports, and a 75% increase for transit funding. Sounds good, right? Expansion of the earned income tax credit for the working poor, free community college, expansion of child care and education credits, paid sick leave and expanded unemployment benefits, et cetera, et cetera. All that looks really good. But on the expense side, it's weighed against that enormous bump for the Pentagon, and in particular, that huge chunk of money for ISIS to fight ISIL. Now, on the income side is the tricky part because, as we know, a Republican Congress isn't going to want to collect more tax revenue for the government, isn't going to want to collect more revenue for the government, period. Obama is asking them to do a couple of things that they really will dig in their heels and not do. One of them is to charge businesses a one-time 14% tax on $2 trillion of profits that American corporations have parked in accounts overseas to keep it from being taxed in the United States. And then thereafter, the second thing would be to charge 19% tax every year on U.S. businesses' annual foreign earnings, less any tax that they pay in the foreign jurisdiction where they've earned that money. So kind of, you know, if you think about it, the nominal corporate tax rate is 35%. Obama wants to reduce that nominal tax rate for all corporations to 28% or 25% if you're a manufacturer of goods. And that's kind of his little gift to corporations to make up for the fact that he wants to tax their foreign earnings. Now, a lot of companies pay zero tax because they get enough tax credits or they take advantage of loopholes in the tax system. But one of those major loopholes has been to keep your foreign earnings abroad so that they can't be taxed here in the United States. And on those foreign earnings, a lot of companies pay zero tax because they park them in countries that have attract business by saying you corporations don't have to pay any tax if you do business here. Places like Ireland, the Cayman Islands, places like Bermuda. People, you know, companies don't actually do business there, but they have their foreign headquarters listed at a P.O. box there. And then they can say, well, that's our tax jurisdiction. Therefore, we don't have to pay tax on any of our foreign earnings. So some of the companies that have a lot of money stashed abroad include GE, which has $110 billion in foreign earnings that it's paid zero tax on. Microsoft has $74 billion. The pharmaceutical company Pfizer has $69 billion. Apple has about $55 billion. So there's just a huge amount of money, up to $2 trillion as an estimate. So the U.S. government could, with that one-time 14% tax, immediately take in $280 billion, and then a 19% annual tax, even more revenue would come in. Now, Congress, the Republicans, they would love to lower the corporate income tax to near zero. And corporations, the last time they had a tax amnesty that allowed them to bring some of that cash home, the government of George W. Bush said, well, we will charge you 5.25% on all cash you want to bring home. That's less than we pay in sales tax here in the state of Washington. And corporations are lobbying Congress to get another tax amnesty of about 5%. So that's kind of what's going on in Congress right now. And I doubt very much that Obama's budget will survive that process of winding its way through Congress.
Anyway. Right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Also this week, the National Security Strategy coming out.
Yeah. I don't know, John, if you read the National Security Strategy. It was released yesterday, late yesterday. So
I saw a summary of it, but I have not read the entire document, no.
I spent a couple hours last night reading most of it. There were a couple parts that I skimmed. But it's pretty amazingly hypocritical document. It starts out on the first page, and I'm just going to quote part of it. It just said, quote, America must lead. Strong and sustained American leadership is essential to a rules-based international order. And he kind of carries that theme, and it kind of carries that theme throughout the document.
Depends what the rules are.
Yeah, and my thought was, when I read that sentence, was, but we break the rules constantly. The United States constantly breaks the rules. For example, drone strikes, which really are assassinations, you know, illegal under international law.
I'm going to talk about drone strikes also when we get to talking about burning people alive.
Yeah. Cyber attacks. There are several portions of the document that talk about cyber defense, but make no mention of the fact that the U.S. has probably the strongest cyber attack capability in the world and has been using it for at least 10 years, probably longer. Torture of prisoners and indefinite detentions without trial. The document continually says, "Oh, we're a leader in eliminating torture and bringing terrorist suspects to trial." That's BS, complete BS, as I said, completely hypocritical. And in fact, it led me to ask, "Well, what about the International Criminal Court, which no American is subject to?" In fact, the document mentions the International Criminal Court as one of those collaborative international institutions that we support I'm still waiting.
Except that we haven't signed the treaty that enables it.
Yes, I'm still waiting for that to actually happen. Mass collection of data and mass surveillance of literally everybody, American citizens, foreign citizens, the foreign heads of state, allies, enemies, you name it. That's, you know, not legal under international law, but we do it. Support for dictatorships that engage in severe violations of human rights. You know, I'm sure Jav can name a few of them, right? Saudi Arabia.
that does come to
Egypt,
mind right now, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Israel.
Bahrain.
Israel. Yeah. Iraq, a government that we helped put into place. You know, I mean, all of these examples just came to mind as I was starting to read the document. And as I read through it, it was pretty hard going because just about every other paragraph I would laugh and go, really? You know, we're against the spread of nuclear weapons, and yet we're set to invest huge, enormous sums of money in upgrading our own nuclear arsenal. It's just continuous. But it really undermines the call throughout the document for collective action, not just America going out and fighting wars on its own, but collective action, getting together with other nations to, I guess, police the world.
Yeah, getting together with other nations to have those nations essentially endorse whatever wars of choice the United States chooses to pursue.
Yeah, and to impose our moral values on other nations, values that we don't particularly follow ourselves. So that was really what I got out of reading that document.
All right. Moving on. Professor Sami Al-Arian.
Yes, this is a name that a lot of people don't know, but many people should. He's one of the earliest victims of the War on Terror in 2003. John Ashcroft began to prosecute him for allegedly supporting terrorist organizations through people may remember during the Bush era, a real crackdown on Islamic charities around the world and people giving money to them. But in the case of Al-Arian was probably the highest profile person who was prosecuted under that push. His support was actually for Palestinians and Palestinian charities, and was charged with a number of crimes because of his support of some charities. And his when he went to trial and he was acquitted of most of those charges, the most of the evidence that was marshaled against him, despite 3 years of being held in solitary, enormous amounts of surveillance, etc., most of the evidence was his public statements in support of Palestinian rights, which the last anybody checked is not actually
really
an illegal thing to advocate.
Is persecuting someone for speech. It's
yeah,
a violation
so his,
of free
you know,
speech.
His basically his reputation, his family, his professional livelihood, all that was destroyed, and he wound up under a plea bargain, agreeing to a deportation. That deportation finally happened this past week, where he was sent off to Turkey, and he'd been a U.S. citizen since 1975, and his quote when he was interviewed literally at the airport last week was, you know, he came to the United States in order to get his freedom. Now he's leaving the United States in order to get his freedom. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a sad commentary on how the U.S. itself has devolved over the last really 40 years, but especially the last 10.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with Israel.
Yeah. Israel, people may have heard of refuseniks, people who refuse the mandatory military service, but a pretty significant case that came to light this week, Israel expelling from its military 43 people in its electronic surveillance unit who were refusing to enact Israel's surveillance policies in the Palestinian territories. This is very interesting because we're talking about a lot of the same kind of technology that the United States routinely uses on its own citizens. Israel has also been using to monitor Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and a significant refusal movement within the Israeli military over that, where those practices are much more controversial than they are here in the United States.
Yeah, here we had Edward Snowden, one guy who was a contractor, not an actual direct employee of the U.S. government.
In this case, we had 43 different pretty elite military personnel who have now been expelled from the military, but you'll notice not prosecuted or forced into exile because of their refusal.
And here in the United States, we don't just try to prosecute the whistleblower. We go after the reporters who report on those whistleblowers, too. So that's part of, I think, the reason why a lot of people don't come forward and talk about these kinds of things.
Yeah. And a similar development in another one of those dictatorships that the United States supports, even though they have terrible human rights records, Bahrain, where the U.S. Fifth Fleet is headquartered in one of the Gulf states, revoked his citizenship of 73 activists and bloggers. In this case, even though it's the regime there is Sunni and they, with U.S. support during the Arab Spring, were pretty vicious in their repression of a Shia-led uprising for more democracy. In this case, it was both Shia and Sunni activists who were expelled by Bahrain. So it's a pretty clearly a direct repression of free speech kind of action, and the kind of action that simply cannot be taken if the United States objected to it in any kind of serious way, because the U.S. bankrolls so much of Bahrain's economy.
Yet, right. And yet another one of our allies doing bad things that don't match our quote-unquote stated values.
Speaking of which, a good article this week from Glenn Greenwald in The Intercept.
Yeah, talking about ISIL and the enormous amount of outrage that was generated by the release of a video by ISIL this week, which showed the burning alive of a Jordanian prisoner who was literally put in a cage and then burned alive. And that's a pretty horrific practice, and a lot of people were horrified by it. But missing from all the U.S. media accounts of that is that the United States has a long and proud history of burning people alive and has pretty much pioneered it. I mean, really, even going back to World War II and the firebombing of Dresden and Tokyo, where we're not talking about one person, we're talking about tens, even hundreds of thousands of people who were burned alive in that way. Napalm during the Vietnam War, which was designed to burn people alive. And you go right up to the drone program now, which primarily operates by incinerating people, one of the reasons it's generated so much outrage in places like Yemen and some of the other places where we've done drone strikes is the targeting of civilians and wedding parties and whatnot, where people literally are incinerated, or the survivors suffer really horrific burns. That's the primary kind of injuries that they get through these drone strikes. So, you know, the United States has a reputation for this in the rest of the world. And so you're really talking about the moral difference between targeting one person in a cage and, somebody in a bunker in Nevada pushing a button and being able to do a pretty similar thing to large numbers of people at once. What's the moral difference there?
All right. Events.
Several events coming up this week. Today, there's a big one in Cal Anderson Park, Walking While Black. This in response to the incident last summer of a elderly African-American man who was harassed on Capitol Hill by Officer Whitlatch for carrying a golf club and walking. And so a number of people are going to show up in Cal Anderson Park today with golf clubs and go for a walk. So that'll be at 2:00 at Cal Anderson Park. Bring your sporting wear. And it's raining, so it's a fine day for golf clubs and a stroll in the park and in Capitol Hill.
And an umbrella. And golf club in one hand, umbrella in the other.
There you go. And then on Friday, this is something well worth checking out, and another piece of good news, because we've already exceeded our quotas. We're being reckless today. 13 different licenses have been, 11 have been granted, and two more are on the verge of being granted for new low-power FM stations, community stations in the Puget Sound region, several in the city of Seattle itself, and then others in suburban areas. So those will all be going on air in the next year or so, hopefully. The licenses have been granted or being granted, and so they'll all be getting together and having a party to celebrate and talk about their different projects. Celebrate Radio, the big power of local new low-power FM, from 5:30 to 7:30 this coming Friday at the Central Library in Seattle. That's on the 10th floor, so use the 5th Avenue entrance between 4th and 5th on Spring in downtown Seattle.
All right.